What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello and welcome to The Katie Halper Show. Please rate and review The Katie Halper Show on iTunes. And of course, support the show at Patreon. Patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's Patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. And speaking of Patreon and Patreon only, you know, I released a really good episode this week that everyone should check out with Faiza Shaheen, who ran as a labor candidate and lost, but did significant damage to her Tory opponent, and also is just a very inspiring person and very vulnerable and open in our interview about what the loss, labor's loss means, and also what can be done moving forward. So I really recommend that. But why do I bring that up? I bring that up because right now you're about to hear an extra episode, but you know, I can't make it Patreon only because it's about the situation in Iran, and that's too important, and I don't really want to profit off of war and peace issues. So this is just a free bonus episode, and I don't even want to say bonus because bonus makes it sound like it's not that important. It's an additional to my usual output episode that I'm offering for free because I can't be a war profiteer, unlike everyone who you see on Fox News, although who am I kidding, you guys don't watch Fox News, but unlike everyone on Fox News and even some people on MSNBC, I'm not going to be a war profiteer. So what I'm doing is I'm releasing an interview with an extremely learned guest, Juan Cole. And then stand by because I'm releasing even more episodes on this issue because, again, the whole Iran thing is pretty important. So you're going to hear an interview that I did with Trita Parsi, who is the co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And he's also the founder and former president of the National Iranian American Council. And I also speak to Ali Gharib, who is an Iranian American journalist at The Intercept. So I get all these different perspectives on what's happening now in Iran. And I really recommend this stuff because it's pretty important. And I'm going to be getting even more on this. Also stand by for Patreon only episodes and bonuses. So you're going to have you're going to hear from Megan Day from Jacobin. She's going to read her I'm Gay and Want Medicare for All piece. I also really, really, really recommend this week's Patreon-only episode, which I released with Faiza Shaheen. So, of course, I gave you a full interview with Faiza Shaheen. I have a really good bonus Patreon-only episode with Faiza Shaheen where she answers questions from listeners and people on Twitter, and really great questions, actually, about the British elections and what's next. She also shares with us an op-ed that she wrote about her opponent, who was recently knighted by the Queen, which is pretty disgusting. I mean, the knighting, not her piece. And I also bring you some audio of the people who were supporting her and stumped for her, and that includes, wait for it, Hugh Grant and Eddie Izzard. Other stuff is coming down the pike. Some of my discussion with Ali and Trita will be Patreon only. But again, it would be great if you just supported the show, not just for the bonus content, which of course is great if I do say so myself, but just to support the show for, you know, releasing extra episodes on Iran. Yeah. Okay. So without any further ado, here is Juan Cole. Juan Cole is the founder and chief editor of Informed Comment. He is Richard P. Mitchell Professor of History at the University of Michigan and an adjunct professor at Gulf Study Center, Qatar University. He's the author of, among many other books, Muhammad, Prophet of Peace and the Clash of Empires. You can follow him online at J-R-I-C-O-L-E. And make sure you check out his recent pieces at Informed Comment, which is the website that he edits, and that is at juancole.com. So thank you so much, Juan Cole, for joining me today.
Well, it's my pleasure, Katie.
And you are a really expert in this field, in the field of the Middle East. So I wanted to talk to you, of course, about what's happening right now in Iran. And also you have a piece that you wrote, which people can find at your website, Informed Comment, called Trump Has Conducted a War on Iran for 19 Months. Iran Finally Hit Back. So can you tell us about that piece?
Yes, well, Trump is the one who created this entire crisis from A to Z. Iran signed a treaty with the United Nations Security Council, including the United States, in 2015, agreeing to mothball 80% of its nuclear enrichment program, which was a civilian nuclear enrichment program to make fuel for its nuclear reactors that provide electricity and are located in Bushehr. But it gave up its enrichment activities to a large extent and agreed to international United Nations regular inspections. And, you know, no country under active inspection has ever developed a nuclear weapon. It's because, I mean, if you make plutonium, the instruments can tell. And there's no way, you know, you can't run a vacuum cleaner and clean it up afterwards.
Right.
This signature is there. Things seemed well in hand for the foreseeable future with regard to Iran's nuclear capabilities. They haven't had a weapons program since 2003, but there was always a worry that they would get more and more sophisticated on the civilian side and at some point might go military. But the deal forestalled that development. And there was a prospect of Iran rejoining the international community. In return for Iran's dismantling of its program, the United Nations Security Council guaranteed Iran the lifting of all economic sanctions on its economy, which had crippled it. Trump, in May of 2018, breached the agreement. People say he pulled out of it. If you sign a treaty, you don't pull out of the treaty, you break it.
Right.
So he broke that treaty. And despite the fact that the UN kept saying that Iran was in complete adherence to all of the provisions, and Trump then slapped the most severe sanctions on Iran that have ever been applied to any country in peacetime. Not just sanctions, really. It's beyond sanctions. He put a blockade on the Iranian economy. He prevented them from exporting their petroleum. And he did all this without any warrant of law. That is to say, there's no UN Security Council resolution. There's no act of Congress. It's just Trump. It's one person.
And,
right. Iran's petroleum exports fell from 2.5 million barrels a day, which was one of the higher export totals in the world, to 500,000 a day. Petroleum provides 70% of the Iranian income. So Trump has just strangled the Iranian economy. It's like putting a pillow over a baby in its crib.
Mm. Were you surprised by this, by the way? Was it something you were expecting? Or
I was surprised on both accounts. I was surprised that Trump ordered the assassination of General Soleimani. Assassination, by the way, is illegal in U.S. law since the Gerald Ford presidency.
Not that it stops us, really. Doesn't seem to.
Well,
sadly, yeah.
There's assassinations and assassinations. This was done on third party soil in Iraq,
right?
And it was a high government official of Iran. It wasn't some seedy terrorist.
Sure, but and, I mean, So it's egregious even within the egregious assassination category.
Yes, I would say so. In fact, it's unprecedented. I've been observing U.S. foreign policy all my life. I've never seen anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was also surprised that the Iranians replied in the way that they did, although they very carefully avoided causing U.S. troop casualties, and they had a pretty good control over those rockets that they sent off. So that was deliberate on their part to avoid casualties. Although they avoided the casualties, they struck openly at U.S. Military facilities and from Iranian soil. That also surprised me. That's not the way the Iranians have usually operated.
So what do you mean by that? How have they usually operated?
Well, in response to the maximum pressure, the economic blockade that Trump has slapped on them, they have acted out. They've pushed back against it. The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia are two U.S. allies that have joined in strangling Iran. So there have been attacks on UAE tankers, and the Saudi refining facility at Abqaiq was hit. But these attacks, which Iran was somehow almost certainly behind, were done in a way that they had no clear Iranian footprint. You couldn't prove that Iran had done them.
Right.
Indeed, there's some thinking that some of the destruction in Saudi Arabia must have come from local Shiite groups, maybe allied with Iran. So the Iranians haven't usually just struck out openly from their territory.
And why is Trump doing this? Why did he do this? What's the role of Pompeo? What's the role of the trolling and the oil? In fact, you have a piece called Trump Troll in Chief Wags the Impeachment Dog by Going to War with Iran, which is a great piece. How much of this is related to being a distraction from impeachment? And of course, as I believe Michael Moore pointed this out on Twitter, of course, he's not the first president to use the international stage as a distraction from impeachment. And we saw that with Bill Clinton also.
That's right. I think several things came together for this missile strike on drone strike on Soleimani and his colleagues. One was that Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, is an Iran war hawk. And there's some reporting that he began plotting for this outcome several months ago. And so there are people around Trump who wanted this. And I don't think Trump necessarily wanted it. He, for all of his bluster, typically has not done things that would cause potentially a full-out war. He would drop a huge bomb on Afghanistan, but then that would be it.
Or
bomb Syria and then back off. But this could have, it doesn't seem like it will at the moment, but it could have very easily spiraled out into a war. So I think Pompeo was one of those who gave Trump this option. And my guess is that it worked for Trump in a number of ways. One was, of course, it did take the spotlight off of the impeachment. And we know that Trump is, Dave Chappelle said that we elected an internet troll as our president.
Right.
That whenever the news is negative for Trump, he trolls us by tweeting out some outrageous thing or you know, shifting the focus. And then he's very good at getting those panels on the cable news networks, which have replaced the news, to just chatter on about his latest tweet. So he actually can manipulate what Americans are talking about in this way. So I think that's part of what was going on, is he wanted to get the impeachment off of the front pages. But also, he and Esper had ordered these airstrikes, now it's easy to forget, the previous Sunday on bases of the Iraqi Shiite militia, Kitab Hezbollah, in response to which, on Wednesday after the strikes, that militia invaded the premises of the U.S. embassy in the Green Zone in Baghdad. And Trump and Pompeo and others in the Republican Party kind of made their bread and butter by attacking Hillary Clinton over the Benghazi attack on the U.S. consulate in 2011. So I think Trump had this horror that he'd be laughed at and looked upon as a Hillary Clinton with this embassy invasion, for which the U.S. was clearly not prepared. It boggles my mind that Pompeo and Esper and Trump could sit down and say, well, let's bomb Iraqi militias in Iraq and not do anything extra for U.S. embassy protection.
Right.
I mean, isn't it just foreseeable that this would happen? So I think by killing Soleimani, he avoided being reduced to a Hillary Clinton or a Jimmy Carter, and tried to look macho.
Right.
So for Trump, I think it was very personal.
Right.
And had to do with his impeachment, had to do with his positioning himself for his base as a macho figure. For people like Pompeo and maybe Esper, I think it was more strategic in presenting Trump with this possibility.
Right. And in fact, there was a lot of, in terms of the personal dimension of this, I didn't realize this until I saw Amy Goodman, an interview on Democracy Now! With a professor. I have to look up who she is. But she was great, and I'm embarrassed I can't remember her name. But she was talking about all the kind of the meme war that was fought, the war of memes online between Soleimani and Trump, which I thought was kind of interesting. And of course, I think Trump kind of met a troll, his troll equal online, which I think maybe offers a slight window into how much it's based on personal conflict.
Yes, I think with this man who, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist,
right.
I couldn't diagnose him, but there's obviously, from my layman's point of view, something very wrong with him.
Right, yeah.
I think most of the things that he does are about him.
Yeah, right. And in this case, it really has an impact. Yeah, I mean, I think there's been kind of an over, you know, we see every day there's a new article about his brain, his psychology, his alleged psychiatric disorder. But I think this is, and I think sometimes that people miss like the structural context or the historic context and how what Trump is doing fits into that. But this is a case that does seem to me, as you said, something really about him. Also, I just want to make sure that people know, listeners know, of course, people know that Pompeo is the U.S. Secretary of State, and most listeners know, I think, that Esper, who you referred to, that's Mark Esper, who is defense secretary. Just want to make sure all listeners know the cast of characters. Can you talk about Soleimani? Because I feel like there's not a lot of, in the United States, people don't really have a clear sense of who he is and how he's viewed in Iran. Can you talk about him as a figure?
Yeah, Soleimani stood out for being particularly popular in Iran, according to opinion polling that was done by the University of Maryland. Some 82% of Iranians had a highly favorable or favorable view of him last fall. They also felt that his activities, he's the head of the special forces of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, the Jerusalem Brigade or the Quds Brigade, and has been active in supporting militias in Lebanon, with Hezbollah in Syria and in Iraq. He's kind of parlayed the Hezbollah model out into these countries among Shiite populations in particular, and projected Iranian soft power and a bit of hard power as well. He came to prominence initially fighting in the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s, which was an eight-year horrible war, World War I style with trenches, and in which the United States swung around to support Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi Ba'ath Party against Iran. And the Iraqis had invaded Iran quite illegally. So Soleimani cut his teeth fighting Iraq and the U.S. Backing for Iraq, and I think formed a poor image of the U.S. because of all that. And then he developed this special forces of the Revolutionary Guards Corps, which is the Guards Corps is really kind of the Iranian National Guard. It's distinct from the conventional Iranian army. And after Bush, George W. Bush invaded Iraq in 2003 and inadvertently, I think, brought the Iraqi Shiites to power. And those Shiites had been close to Soleimani. The Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq is a major party, had a paramilitary called the Butter Corps that used to fight Saddam. And the Butter Corps is really, you know, just a brigade of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps filled by Iraqi expatriates. They probably got their money from Iran. They certainly got their training and material from Iran, their weaponry. So, and that group, the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq and the Butter Corps, they were allied de facto with the United States in the Bush era. Because they had been anti-Saddam, and they were happy that the United States got rid of Saddam. And Paul Bremer, who was the Bush viceroy in Iraq initially, actually appointed the head of the Islamic Supreme Council to his interim governing council. So there were moments that the United States and Soleimani were hand in glove. They were actual allies de facto. And this occurred again after 2014 when ISIL or ISIS arose. The initial response to that terrorist group in northern Iraq came from Soleimani and the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps and then those Iraqi Shiite militias that he helped to form and back. And they planned out an attack on ISIL in Tikrit, north of Baghdad, which was Saddam Hussein's birthplace, and got bogged down. And the Obama administration initially didn't approve of this entire thing. They wanted the U.S. to be the lead force, not Iran. But when they got when the Iraqis got bogged down and the Iranians in the Tikrit campaign, the U.S. decided that it would look bad for PR purposes not to have this victory against ISIL once the campaign had begun. And they gave close air support to Soleimani. So this rhetoric you hear nowadays that, oh, he's a bad guy, he's the worst guy in the world, he's killed millions. Yeah, I mean, first of all, he hasn't killed millions. I don't know why they say that or where exactly those millions were. But
right. Yeah, but it's unquestioned.
He was a military commander. And sometimes he was on the opposite side from the United States. Sometimes he was on the same side. But his major activities in recent times have been fighting Al-Qaeda-linked groups in Syria or fighting ISIL in Iraq. You would think that would make him a kind of ally of the U.S.,
right. The media, of course, I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but the media is not at all questioning that framing and narrative about Soleimani. In fact, I believe it was CNBC that tweeted that the U.S. had killed world's biggest bad guy.
Yeah. I don't know what's wrong with American journalists that, you know, Edward R. Murrow or Walter Cronkite would never have talked like that.
Right.
And I think even Tom Brokaw, you know, is really upset about where journalism, television journalism has gone. Calling somebody a bad guy is not journalism.
Yeah, it's really embarrassing. Yeah, as Nando Villa quoted, our media is run by literal children. And by the way, thank you for, I didn't know this until you told me this during an interview that we did last year, which was that Pompeo is himself an evangelical. In my Italo ignorance, I just assumed he was Roman Catholic. And you then set me straight about not just Pompeo, but a whole history of evangelical Italian Americans, which I didn't know about. So how much is this informed by that view, a religious view of the world versus a material view?
Well, I think for Pompeo, the hard right evangelical framing is extremely important to understand what he's about. I mean, he gave a speech in which he said he thought the rapture was imminent.
Wow. Yeah, that's very scary. And do you think he believes that, or is that pandering?
I don't know. How would I know? I can't
right,
be
you can't be in his head, yeah.
Either
way, it's scary.
He's the equivalent of that guy in the New Yorker cartoons that holds up the sign with the long beard saying the end is near.
Right.
It's very scary to have him as Secretary of State.
Yeah. And what do you think can be done now moving forward?
Well, I mean, practically speaking, getting this maniac out of the White House is the biggest thing that needs to be done. If your listeners are not actively canvassing for somebody else to be president, then they're implicated in all of these disasters. Trump is just erratic, and he wakes up in the morning and just does the craziest things. And this, you know, is the real world. The consequences of all this could be dire. For one thing, it seems to me very likely that Trump's behavior has ensured the departure in a fairly swift time frame of U.S. troops from Iraq. The Iraqi parliament met and voted that the U.S. troops should leave. The U.S. Political class and the journalists say it's an advisory vote. It's not an advisory vote. It was a vote of parliament, and it charged the executive with making the arrangements for the troops to leave. But it was a vote of parliament. It was decisive, and the resolution was presented to the parliament by the executive, by Adel Abdel Mahdi, the prime minister. And he wanted this and got it. So he actually. CENTCOM sent over a letter to Abdel Mahdi letting him know that there would be troop movements, that they were going to try to thin out the U.S. military presence in Baghdad itself, because in Baghdad, they're near to those Shiite militias whose leader they killed, and they're afraid there will be attacks on U.S. troops. So they're sending several hundred out to Kuwait, just out of Iraq, and they're distributing others to bases that are further away from the Shiites, I think, maybe out to Ain al-Assad in Al-Anbar, or up to the base in Kurdistan. So, and as part of that letter, the CENTCOM said that this is in preparation for the U.S. troops getting out of Iraq altogether in accordance with the Iraqi parliament vote. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper has attempted to downplay this letter. He said it wasn't signed. It was from the U.S., and it actually, there's an Arabic version of it that both sides had to agree with, and Abdel Mahdi's office and the U.S. military went back and forth on it. So it was quite deliberate, this letter. And it's also correct. The U.S. military, I think, will have to leave Iraq if the Iraqi government doesn't want them there, because they have no legal framework to operate in somebody else's country. And the U.S. troops, you know, if there were a firefight and somebody was killed, they could be charged with murder in Iraqi civil courts.
Right. So there's something trending on Twitter right now. It's I voted for Hillary Clinton. It's a reference to what is happening now in Iran. But there is some pushback to that framing, and that a lot of people are pointing that out, that Hillary herself had said a lot of hawkish things about Iran. This is a counterfactual, obviously, because she's not president. But what do you think of that comparison? What do you think Hillary would have been like in this role?
Hillary is, relatively speaking, an Iran hawk, but she did pledge to observe the 2015 Iran nuclear deal.
Right.
So, you know, if we play this out in our minds, and assuming that she did follow through on her pledge, then Iran's buying Boeing airplanes. It's getting reintegrated into the world economy. It's pumping oil and selling it all around the world. When you get integrated into the world economy in that way, and then there's no sanctions on it, it's mothballed its nuclear program. It's not a pariah. Then it will develop friends and relationships and be open to international pressure. And so I think this entire crisis doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think on the Iran issue, that trend on Twitter is correct.
Okay. Yeah.
Those people who said we should vote for Trump because he won't get us into a war with Iran, whereas Hillary will, were wrong.
Wrong, right.
Now, on other issues, I think it's very possible that Hillary would have sent a big U.S. military force into Syria.
Mm-hmm. Right.
She's really, really pro-Israeli in her current incarnation. And I say that because back in the 90s, she said that Palestinians should have rights.
Right. She called it an occupation. Right.
Yes, she hasn't said anything like that for 20 years.
Right.
So I think the indications were that she might well have gotten us into a war in Syria, but not Iran.
Mm-hmm, right. So you're saying while she's in other areas, she's perhaps more hawkish than Trump, this is a country where that's not true. That wouldn't have been true.
I think that's based on what she said,
sure.
Her announced policies. And I think, you know, she was part of the Obama administration and she supported that nuclear deal. I just think that the nuclear deal would have forestalled these kinds of military tensions with Iran.
Right. And how unprecedented is this moment, historically speaking? I mean, how do you, both as like a, I guess as a person who has just lived through history and witnessed history, and also as a scholar?
Well, it's not unprecedented for the United States to be at war with countries, and so there's nothing that unusual about it. What's strange is this targeting of a state official. So the United States never killed a Soviet general, for instance. They thought about it, I have to tell you, but they never did it.
Right.
And one of the reasons you don't do that is because you want your generals targeted.
Right.
So I think that Trump crossed a line here with regard to normal war practice. And it's just unclear where that will go. And I think if Iran does succeed in moving U.S. troops out of Iraq, because, by the way, you know, if the U.S. troops leave Iraq, the several hundred U.S. troops that are in Tanf down there in southeast Syria in the middle of nowhere, which were intended to block Iranian equipment supplies to Hezbollah, those troops would be extremely exposed. You never want to put U.S. troops on the ground in a place where they can't easily be rescued by helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
So you want a helicopter base somewhere nearby. And at the moment, you know, that helicopter base is in Iraq. But if the U.S. were to leave Iraq, then how would those troops in Syria be rescued if they got into trouble? You could maybe do it from Turkey, but it's a stretch. So I think they have to leave, too. Trump won't be crying any tears about this because he said he wanted to get out of the Middle East. But the U.S. Military presence in the Fertile Crescent may be over with as a direct result of Trump's actions, and much sooner and in a way that he didn't anticipate.
And would that be good?
Well, to the extent that those troops in Iraq are training the Iraqi army and helping in various ways with mopping up the remnants of ISIL, and the U.S. troops in Syria still do have that role of keeping an eye out to make sure that ISIL doesn't resurge as well, I think there is a danger here of an ISIL resurgence. I mean, it's a horrible group. I will break journalistic standards and talk about them dirty. But they, they behead people, enslave women, and so forth. But they could come back. They haven't disappeared, and they still do probably hold some small bits of territory in northern Iraq. To the extent that the U.S. gets out and the Iraqi army is not good at fighting them and the Syrian army is a mess, that could be a danger. And, you know, those guys blew up Paris, so having them resurge would not be pleasant.
Yeah. Also, I mean, it's funny because the combination of that plus taking out this major anti-ISIS general is pretty interesting. And what do you think, what can be done besides advocating for another, you know, working to defeat Trump? And of course, I'm, as you probably know, and listeners definitely know, for me, that person is Bernie Sanders. And he's also been, I think, the best on this issue, kind of unequivocally, along with Tulsi Gabbard, on this issue, unequivocally condemning this as and calling it an assassination and not kind of waffling over it. What can be done, though, now while Trump still is president?
Well, I think it's good for people to rally.
Yeah.
I think anti-war rallies and sort of letting the press know about them, getting them on television, sort of letting Trump know, because regardless of what he says, he's really, really tied in to the public mood.
Yeah.
Letting him know that what he's done is extremely unpopular, especially the possibility of it spiraling, is all to the good.
Right.
He's very narcissistic. And so having large numbers of people in the streets criticizing him, again, he will deny this, but it certainly would hurt his feelings. And we want him to know that we don't like this.
Right. Also, I mean, I think that he should be, you know, this is something he really did campaign against, right? Or campaign around his alleged anti-interventionism and anti, you know, he posed military adventurism. So I think if there's a way for people who, I mean, maybe this is wishful thinking, but people who usually support him, maybe, you know, we, his usual critics, maybe we can reach out to them and remind them that, you know, part of one of the things he promised was not getting involved internationally. Because this is one of the things that I really think, unlike other things, which people don't care about. I mean, no one who supports Trump cares about the Russia stuff. No one cares about how he breaks with the presidential decorum. In fact, I think people like that about him, people who support him. But I'm hoping that maybe this is something his regular supporters will rally against.
I really think you've put your finger on it, Katie. You know, about 14% of the white working class that had voted for Obama defected to Trump.
Right.
The statistic is smaller than people think, but I mean, most of Trump's voters were fairly well off.
Right.
But there was that defection, and it was, you know, it was unemployed steel and auto workers here in Michigan who were attracted by Trump's promises to bring the jobs back and to put tariffs on China and that kind of thing. But again, they very much don't want more U.S. blood and treasures expended in the Middle East for no good reason. And I think this kind of thing could hurt Trump among them. And certainly we should reach out to them and get them back.
Right. Yeah. And of course, yeah, and if the media focused on that aspect of it, as opposed to kind of just the formality and decorum of it, that would probably be helpful. And any other predictions that you have, or are we on the brink of some kind of existential moment?
No, it seems as though both Trump and Iran agree that this is not a good time for them to go to all-out war.
Yeah.
This is an episode in a a long-term shadow struggle between the United States and Iran. I think, you know, looking out as a historian, now I'm getting into my late 60s, so I think in the long term, I really think that petroleum is over with within 10 to 15 years. I think a lot of countries will just outlaw it. You see what all of Australia is on fire.
Oh, yeah. It's so awful.
And, you know, this is only the beginning. We're at early stages of this stuff. So burning petroleum is very bad for human beings and other living things and for the Earth. So I think there's going to be a whole new fleet of electric cars coming out in September. And Volkswagen is going big into it. I think they're coming down in price dramatically. Renewable energy is becoming cheaper and cheaper. You can now just make a solar farm or a wind farm and run it more cheaply than continuing to run a coal plant. So it's not very long from now that people will all be driving electric vehicles and getting their energy from the sun and wind. And petroleum will become worthless. Well, you still can use it for fertilizer. It won't become completely worthless, but it certainly won't cost, you know, $65 a barrel.
Right.
And so the U.S. interest in the Middle East is mainly that. I think the Navy Fifth Fleet is headquartered at Bahrain in the Gulf for this reason. And so I think, you know, Middle Eastern wars are a limited phenomenon. If we could just get through the next 10 years, that whole region will, you know, be as interesting to U.S. geopolitics as Uruguay or Senegal are right now, which is not interesting. And the focus, I think, will move on to the Pacific Rim. What I say is, you know, are you against Middle East war, then buy an electric car. Put solar panels on your roof if you have a roof. Pressure your local city council to declare a climate emergency and go to renewables. The two things are connected. The climate activism and anti-war activism with regard to the Middle East are intimately connected in ways I think that are not underlined enough.
Yeah. And anything else you want to say before you go? Because I know you have to go to
teach. Go.
What are you talking about today in class?
I am teaching a course for the first time on the history of happiness.
Whoa. Wow. How'd you get that? How'd you get
I invented
your department to... you are a very established...
Department was... I gave them... I wanted to do a new course, and I gave them some possibilities, and I mentioned this one. And the department was very enthusiastic that I should do it.
That's
we have a crisis of depression amongst the undergraduates in higher education across the board. They're a third more depressed, according to the scales, than they were even 5 years ago. There's an uptick in suicide.
Yeah, it's awful. Yeah.
So I think the higher-ups in the administration, when they heard I wanted to do this, were very happy about it. I can't promise to make the students happy, but I can tell them, you know, what Plato and the Sufis and the Buddhists all said about
happiness. That's really interesting. Wow. So it's called The History of Happiness?
Yes.
Wow.
If you Google Juan Cole and History of Happiness, the syllabus comes right up.
Wow. That's so interesting. Now I'm going to have you on again to talk about that.
Anytime, Katie. I'm a fanboy. So.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm a fangirl. So works out well. Well, thank you again so much for coming on. And just so listeners know, I realized I really need to do an episode on this. And I was like, I'll just ask Juan Cole. I mean, he's so busy. I'm sure he won't be able to do it. But lo and behold, it was a miracle.
I carved out some space for you.
Yes. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome and all the best.
Thanks. You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And here is just a kind of teaser of my chat with Ali Gharib, which will be released shortly, along with an interview with Trita Parsi. Ali Gharib is the senior news editor at The Intercept. He was previously at Mike, where he was the chief politics editor. Before that, he was a contributor to The Nation and a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at The Nation Institute. His work has appeared in The Guardian, Brooklyn Magazine, The New Republic, Foreign Policy Haaretz, and The Daily Beast, among other outlets. He lives in Brooklyn, and you can find him on Twitter, Ali_Gharib. That is Ali_Gharib.
So this started with like a kind of, you know, I mean, I think really, if you want to go take the broader view, the starting point for all this is Trump campaigning on and then withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal. It's really hard to overstate what an important fulcrum that was in Iran, in the Iran-U.S. relationship. I mean, it was really unprecedented and historic in a meaningful way, like not just as a platitude.
Yeah.
You know, because Trump is a racist and wants to reverse and undo everything that Obama did, he wanted to reverse and get out of the Iran deal. It didn't help that, you know, that some of Trump's biggest donors are like arch right-wing Zionists who have dedicated their political giving to basically war with Iran, you know, like in whatever incremental shape that has taken, whether opposing diplomacy with Iran, opposing the nuclear deal, and then asking for it to be dismantled, this absolute total BS line about wanting a better deal. There was a real convergence of interest for Trump, his own like racism and inability to get over Obama, plus the fact that some of his biggest donors and supporters are kind of these arch Zionists. We had Trump like really going in on the nuclear deal. He took it apart, and that started this sort of tit for tat process of recriminations where, you know, Iran sort of stepped up its, you could say harassment, that might even be too strong. It was just like the rhetoric against the US but really it was against the allies. And it mostly played out as a proxy war in places like Iraq, but also there was, purportedly Iranian strike against the Saudi oil facility. There was some harassment of ships in the Persian Gulf. That sort of stuff really ramped up when the Trump abrogated the nuclear deal. And then most recently, there was this tit for tat between militias in Iraq that are Shia militias that are backed by Iran and American forces, including a rocket strike against a base where an American contractor died. And then that kind of started this, like, you know, then there was American airstrikes against some of these Shia militant groups. And then, you know, just more recriminations and kind of crap talking back and forth, which culminated in these militia groups storming the U.S. embassy, and then Trump's response to that, which was assassinating what was arguably the second most powerful man in Iran, this guy Qasem Soleimani, who is the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Quds Force, which is like elite unit basically running like the covert foreign policy of the Iranians throughout the region. So this would be the guy who's coordinating, you know, relationships with Hezbollah, with the Shia militias in Iraq, and with Bashar Assad and Syria and some of the militias supporting him.
Did you hear Trump's speech by any chance?
Yeah, I listened to it.
Yeah.
It wasn't much. I mean, like, this is like the neocon policy par excellence. It's one of like of pretending you don't want war, but then actually doing things that will create a war, including like severely impoverishing Iran and trying to destroy people's lives there in some kind of vain hope that like this weakened and poverty stricken population will rise up and overthrow the Islamic Republic. Like, it's just like a neocon bonkers fantasy run amok where like we blow up Iran's proxies and there's no consequences for it. And like we teetered so close to the edge of a full-fledged war this time that it really puts the lie to this idea that there are no consequences for these things that you do. It's the consequences of backing out of the Iran deal. It's the consequences of trying to engage in this escalating war against with Iran's proxies. It's the consequences of this sanctions policy that's hurting Iranians so badly. I mean, it's just like it's just a neocon fever dream springing to life in front of us, even as they deny that they had anything to do with it. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that the roots go back to getting out of the nuclear deal and this kind of like rising recriminations. And then a couple weeks ago, there was like these Iranian backed Shia militias in Iraq fired these rockets at the U.S. base. Then the U.S. blew up a bunch of militia guys, and then the militia guys hit back by storming the embassy. And then the U.S. blew up Qasem Soleimani and the leader of this Iraqi Shia militia that he was traveling in the car with. And then just last night was just this very, you know, after like some assholes at the State Department kept telling us that Iran wouldn't retaliate militarily at all, and Pompeo said they would, you know, everybody said that nothing would happen. The Iranians did this kind of very measured strike against these, against basically like equipment depots inside the U.S. occupied areas of Iraqi bases. They were Iraqi bases, but the strikes only hit the areas where the U.S. was housed. You know, Iran gave a warning to the Iraqis. They only hit the equipment depots. It seemed like they were trying to get away with making a strike that would be significant. It was apparently dozens of ballistic missiles. And Iran, like, took the opportunity to try and make a statement that, like, hey, we're going to hit you back, and then we want to squash this. And they actually very deftly made that statement, which is kind of incredible, because if you do think back to the days before the Iran deal, you know, there is this constant discussion about the martyr state, and, like, they value suicide so much, and are the Iranians rational enough?
Right.
And now we have these extremely rational Iranians.
Right.
We're making very measured, calculated steps to make sure that they make their point without leading to a full-fledged war. And then we have this totally irrational, maniac fascist running the United States. I mean, it's really astounding to see.
Yeah, great. Thank you so
Looking
much.
Looking forward to checking out. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, of course. Let's do it again.
All right. Bye, Katie.
All right, bye. And that was Ali Gharib. Make sure you tune back, come back around, check out the Patreon-only feed, or join our Patreon, patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow, to hear the rest of my interview with Ali Gharib and to hear my interview with Trita Parsi, who is the co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And he's also the founder and former president of the National Iranian American Council. Thanks again to Ali, as well as to Juan Cole. And here is Juan Cole's more extended biography. And it's so extensive, I had to save most of it for the end. Juan Cole is Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan. For 3.5 decades, he has sought to put the relationship of the West and the Muslim world in historical context. His most recent book is Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. He's also the author of The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East, and many other books. He has translated works of Lebanese-American author Khalil Gibran. He has appeared widely on media, including the PBS NewsHour, ABC, World News Tonight, Nightline, The Tonight Show, Anderson Cooper 360, Chris Hayes All In, CNN, The Colbert Report, Rachel Maddow, Democracy Now!, and many others. He has written about Egypt, Iran, Iraq, the Gulf, and South Asia, and about both extremist groups and peace movements. He has regular columns at The Nation and Truthdig and is proprietor of the Informed Comment News and Analysis site. Cole conducts his research in Arabic, Persian, and Urdu, and Turkish, you know, kind of like me, as well as several European languages. He knows both Middle Eastern and South Asian Islam. He lived in various parts of the Muslim world for more than a decade and continues to travel widely there. He has written, edited, or translated 18 books and authored over 90 articles and chapters. Wow. Also, you can find more about Juan at juancole.com, which is Informed Comment, the website that he runs. And also you can follow him on Twitter at HRICole.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Craving the coffee flavor you love, but without the caffeine? Cachava's got you covered with their newest coffee flavor. This all-in-one nutrition shake delivers bold, authentic flavor crafted from premium decaffeinated Brazilian beans. Quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Cachava's all-in-one nutrition shake and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Whether you're craving that coffee taste to kickstart your morning ritual or as a nutrient-packed reward to round out your afternoon, Cachava keeps you fueled and satisfied wherever your day takes you. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. And for the times you feel like switching it up, you've got 7 flavors to choose from, all with the highest quality ingredients. Treat yourself to the flavor and nutrition your body craves. Go to cachava.com and use code NEWS. New customers get 15% off their first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code NEWS.